Sorensen versus Wadsworth Brothers Construction. This is 21-4005, and the court recognizes Mr. Monahan.
May it please the court, good morning. I am Russell Monahan. I represent the relator here, Kelly Sorensen. We're here on essentially two orders of the court. One was an order on dismissing three counts of the plaintiff's complaint, and then a order on a motion for summary judgment with regards to a retaliation claim from our complaint. Now, the basis of the complaint is a combination of federal statutes, the Davis-Bacon Act combined with the False Claims Act. In dismissing the counts one and two of the plaintiff's complaint, the court determined that the complaint lacked sufficient allegations with regards to materiality. And what this goes to is to make a false claim under the, or to make a claim under the False Claims Act, plaintiff must show a false statement or fraudulent course of conduct was made with the requisite knowledge that it was material and that it resulted in a claim that the government to the government or conceals or decreases or avoids an obligation to pay the government. In this case, what the plaintiff is alleging is that the defendant engaged in a scheme to avoid its obligations under the Davis-Bacon Act. And they did this by creating false timesheets. And then the plaintiff or the defendant then subsequently submitted these false times or certification that the defendant was in compliance with Davis-Bacon to the government in order to receive payments.
Counsel, on this claim, do we have to know in order to conclude there was sufficient showing in your brief or in your complaint? Do we have to know what he was paid, what the rate should have been under the Davis-Bacon Act?
I don't believe initially under the complaint that that is required. We made allegations that he was not being paid in accordance with the Davis-Bacon wage requirements. And I think that that is a factual.
Isn't that conclusory? I mean, don't we have to, doesn't the district court have to have more than that in order to determine if you've stated a claim? I mean, that's just a legal conclusion.
No, because what my client was alleging in his complaint was that he was paid at two different levels. One, he was being paid at a Davis-Bacon wage, and then he was being paid at a reduced rate when the defendant was alleging that he wasn't on site working the Davis-Bacon job when he actually was working the Davis-Bacon job. And therefore, I think that that is sufficient in terms of determining whether or not he was whether his conclusion that he was not being paid his Davis-Bacon wages, I think that's sufficient.
And we can say that's sufficient even though we don't know what the Davis-Bacon rates were.
We are saying that he's being paid. The allegation in the complaints were that he was being paid below the Davis-Bacon wage because he was getting two different rates here, Your Honor. One, he was being paid a Davis-Bacon rate, and one, he was being paid a reduced rate. And his allegation was he worked the entire job on a Davis-Bacon job. Or he worked the entire day on a Davis-Bacon job and they split his rates. And I think that is sufficient information for the court to determine whether or not they, once again, that they are engaged in fraudulent conduct in that they are skimming basically from these employees by showing on their time cards that they are only working part of the day on a Davis-Bacon job, and then part of the day on a non-Davis-Bacon job, and then they are submitting their certified payrolls to the government in order to receive payment, and that that certification is saying that they are being paid in accordance with Davis-Bacon, when in actuality, they're not, because they're skimming money off of these workers. I think what the court needs to do...
Let me ask you this, Mr. Monahan.
Yes.
What allegations do you make specifically as to materiality beyond the allegations that the Davis-Bacon Act is being violated? What are your specific allegations as to why it's material?
Well, throughout our complaint, and this is the other issue, the court picked a single paragraph to draw the broad conclusion that that paragraph or all our allegations were conclusory. When in actuality, once again, this court has said, you have to be holistic in the approach to these complaints, and you have to read these complaints as a whole. Now, if we go through and read the complaint as a whole, we can see a broad spectrum of pattern by the defendant when they're engaged in this fraudulent conduct. And if you want, I can go through these.
It sounds to me like you're telling me what you allege is the violations of the Davis-Bacon Act. What I'm asking for is, what are your allegations as to the materiality of those violations?
Okay. Let me pull them up from my...
Well, I don't want you to spend a lot of your time searching for it. I just want to know, just from your familiarity with the case and the complaint that you drafted, what are the allegations as to materiality?
One of the things we cite to is the fact that they had certain requirements under CFR or 29 CFR section 5.5. And I think that section is very important, and it's contained within paragraph 20 of our complaint. In a recent case.
Well, is that enough? I mean, you're just saying they have these requirements. Don't you have to mix say, and they fail to meet these requirements in this way specifically? We're talking money here. Should they have paid? What didn't they pay? What did they submit to the government as the amount that should be paid?
And I think that would be something that would be appropriate on a motion for summary judgment, but we're here on a motion to dismiss. That information is not necessarily going to be available to a plaintiff at this stance in the case.
Well, let me ask you this. Doesn't it seem like it's more important in this case because you cannot tell me where in that complaint there's an allegation of materiality independent of the alleged violations? If we had specifics as to the violations, then maybe we could draw inferences. Well, that's really important stuff, so it must be material. So what about materiality? What are the allegations?
Once again, in paragraph 20, materiality goes to the fact that we cited to 29 CFR 5.5 saying that they were required to submit these accurate or certify these payrolls. And I think that section is also important because recently the Third
Circuit... I don't see how that differs from what was before the court in Universal Health. Just because you say it's required doesn't mean it's material.
Well, once again, though, I think if the court can review the Third Circuit recently issued a new opinion, and this is cited in our brief, International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 98 versus Farfield. Okay. We cited an earlier decision regarding that case. The Third Circuit 2 months ago, recently just issued a new opinion that's 5F4-315. And they went through the materiality requirements, citing to 29 CFR 5.5, saying they were required, that regulation itself requires that they submit accurate payrolls. Compliance with the relevant Davis-Bacon regulations was mandatory for Fairfield to bid on the contract and for the government to perform under it. Under those regulations, Fairfield workers will be paid unconditionally the full amount of wages computed at not less than those contained in the wage determinations. And so I think from a materiality circumstance, okay, if you analyze, once again, the complaint as a whole, we're saying they bid on this contract knowing that the bid solicitation required that they comply with Davis-Bacon. They received a contract that said you had to comply with Davis-Bacon. There's a federal regulation and a whole statutory scheme requiring them to comply with Davis-Bacon.
Okay, I understand your argument on that. Let me ask this. Is any part of our analysis on materiality, do we consider the fact that the government did not agree to proceed?
And once again, that was also addressed in that Third Circuit case I just cited you to. They indicated that it has little weight because a government's decision not to pursue a case like this may have, you know, many different factors, including the fact that they do not have the resources to conduct the investigation, or that they want to have those resources addressed somewhere else. And therefore, the Third Circuit said, you know, the fact that the government didn't intervene doesn't carry much weight.
I take it the way you carefully articulated it, they didn't say that it's wholly irrelevant, but that it's not.
They did not say it was wholly irrelevant, but they did say it carries very little weight.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Monahan.
And I would just briefly, you know, we believe that the issues with regards to the summary judgment decision and the retaliation complaint, there were a lot of factual disputes, and the trial court simply disregarded Mr. Sorensen's affidavit and his statements as to events and wholeheartedly took as truthful the company's statements. And we believe
do we have any evidence in this record that the company knew that he was making Davis-Bacon complaints?
The court acknowledged that he made complaints to both his supervisor and the person over his supervisor, that he was complaining about Davis-Bacon wages. And so that is in the record. And
did he then also tell them, and if you don't pay me what I'm owed, I'm going to blow the whistle on you people?
Was it
only just, you know, you need to pay me more?
No, he was specifically complaining about not being paid Davis-Bacon wages.
Did he use that expression, Davis-Bacon?
Yes.
Did he, was there any evidence, including in his affidavit, that he complained that they were not just underpaying him, but falsely certifying to the government that they were complying with Davis-Bacon?
There's nothing that indicates that he knew that they were falsely certifying to Davis-Bacon, but I believe under the established law, that wasn't what was required.
Okay, well, I understand that, but I'm afraid I didn't hear an answer to my question. So if he didn't know it, he obviously didn't complain that the government, that he had complained that they were falsely certifying compliance with Davis-Bacon, because he didn't, he didn't even know that they had to certify compliance, right?
Correct.
All right.
And but the I think the question for the court, and I see my time is up, but my question or my answer to the court on that is what he needs to do is notify them that they are in violation of something that's going that potentially could lead to a false claim. And in this case, because they were violating Davis-Bacon by not paying them the wages, that has a sufficient nexus to the false claim. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Judge Murphy, do you have any other questions?
I do not.
Judge Briscoe?
No, I don't, thank you.
All right, thank you. Mr. Beasley, you're recognized.
Your Honors, may it please the court, my name's Wilford Beasley. I represent Appellee Wadsworth Brothers Construction Company. As the court is aware, this action has been going on for many years. In 2014, Mr. Sorensen was furloughed from employment with Wadsworth as a truck driver. There were four truck drivers that worked the crew with Mr. Sorensen. Mr. Sorensen worked for approximately 8 weeks for Wadsworth Brothers. He was the last to be hired and he was the first to be furloughed. I would first like to address the materiality issue that has been presented by Mr. Sorensen. I submit to the court that the Escobar case or Universal Health versus Escobar put the brakes on these false claims actions. The U.S. Supreme Court clearly intended to put parameters in place to prevent the overload of the judicial system of all of these many False Claims Act claims that were frivolous or without merit. The materiality element is the third element required to be presented and be established. And in Escobar, and I'll refer to it as Escobar instead of Universal Health Services because it's easier for me to memorize that, the court stated that materiality is demanding and encouraged the federal courts to vigorously police the False Claims Act for materiality, to vigorously police. The court went on to say that mere technicalities and are not sufficient for under treble damages of the False Claims Act. Thereafter, the Tenth Circuit's followed Escobar in the Janssen case.
Before you move beyond Escobar, as I understand, the Escobar test is that we look to the actual or likely effect of the representation on the recipient of the representation, right?
Correct.
And then on paragraph 54 of the complaint, Wadsworth Brothers performed work on the de-icing project and therefore submitted invoices to the federal government for expenses, including relator Sorensen's wages, and quote, and have been paid in relation to those invoices as a result of the government's reliance on their certifications of Davis-Bacon Act compliance. So as I understand paragraph 54, it is saying, yes, the actual effect on the recipient, the federal government, was to pay Wadsworth Brothers in reliance on these false certifications. So what is deficient under Escobar in light of the allegations in paragraph 54, which the district court didn't even mention paragraph 54, surprisingly.
That's an excellent question, Your Honor. The issue in Escobar, and it's critical to this matter because Sorensen has only cited to statutory preconditions, these conditions precedent as to how the materiality standard has been achieved. And that section in his complaint goes to that. But the Escobar case clearly, that the court clearly held that that's not dispositive alone to establish materiality, that there must be more. In Janssen, there must be more. In the case of Payton and in the case of Metesky, which are Georgia and California district court cases, they said that from Escobar, there must be how, there must be why in the pleadings as to how there is materiality. All we have.
What more, if you were drafting this complaint, could you possibly to say t- to explain how or why it would have a likely effect. They alleged in paragraph 20 that this regulation requires these certifications. He alleges that they underpaid him under Davis-Bacon. He alleges in paragraph 54 that the government specifically paid him in reliance on the certification that they were complying. So if you were drafting it and you would say how they did it, well, we know how they did it. They falsely certified compliance with Davis-Bacon. Why did they do it? Why did the government do it? Well, he told us in paragraph 54. The causation as a result of the false certifications. So how is it deficient for failure to allege how or why?
I would submit that the allegations in the complaint, and specifically that paragraph in the complaint, is nothing more than a conclusory statement of fact, but it's masquerading as a fact. It's just a conclusion. It's citing the element and then just stating a conclusion. And if the court reviews the entire complaint, that is pretty much what the pleadings do, citing the elements of the FCA Act and then concluding that they were violated. Now, I would quickly like to address the Farfield case that Mr. Monahan addressed. It did, the court in July just recently, the Third Circuit did opine on that. I would say that the Farfield case is comparing apples to oranges to our current matter. The Farfield case had to deal with a special master that was appointed in dealing specifically with misclassifications of workers. And the court there determined that materiality had been met by examining the full gamut on a case-by-case basis, looked at what violations of the statute may have been violated. But then the court went on to balance the amount of the violation and then contrasted it also with the fact that laborers were doing work that required certified electricians to perform the work, certified journeymen. And the court found that that was significant and actually impacted the public policy and the safety of the project, in that the contractor was having laborers perform work that should have been performed by electricians. And the court balanced that there to determine materiality. And they did kind of a balancing test. I would submit that that case has nothing to do with this case. I would further state, and I see my time's going, but I want to quickly address this point, is that I submit that Mr. Sorensen's hands were tied. The complaint was drafted in 2016. Please understand that we were well into a year of litigation in the state court proceeding on this exact same issue. And his hands were tied. He couldn't plead more because he knew that if he did plead more details, the facts were not plausible to support a claim for relief. For example, the prevailing wage resource book that's issued by the Department of Labor clearly states that Davis-Bacon wages are not paid to truck drivers when their time on the project is de minimis. Mr. Sorensen didn't get into that at all because he couldn't, because then his claim would fail automatically. But we're dealing with a situation here where obviously the trucks aren't parked inside the airport. They're at the Wadsworth truck yard. And so at a minimum, there's going to be travel time to and from the truck yard to get to the airport. So not every hour that Mr. Sorensen worked on the project was entitled to Davis-Bacon. I think that is a glaring issue that the court needs to examine. I want to move on.
Well, quickly. before you move on, Mr. Beasley, I just have difficulty hypothesizing what specific facts you can allege to establish materiality when you're trying to crawl into the mind of people going over government contracts and determining whether or not they pay things. Before you ever get in discovery, how do you find those kind of facts?
That's a difficult question. I think it needs to be examined on a case by case basis. But the point is that none of the courts, including Escobar, state what exactly needs to be pled. They provide parameters saying what has to be done to achieve materiality. And so that's up to, I can't draft the complaint for Mr. Sorensen. But I will submit to the court that a close review of those allegations are simply citing the statute and simply concluding that they were violated is not enough to establish materiality.
Okay.
The summary judgment, well, conspiracy.
Wait, before you go on, is that Third Circuit case? That's a summary judgment case, isn't it?
The Farfield case, there was a special master appointed at the district court level, and I believe that was then on summary judgment.
Yeah, I would imagine after a special master. Anyway, thank you. Don't waste your time on that.
The district court, moving to the summary judgment, well, first of all, the conspiracy, the district court got it right as well. There was no agreement alleged. That's the first element of the conspiracy claim. Nowhere in the complaint is there any agreement established or even pled that Morgan Stanley and or Alliance Benefit conspired with Wadsworth to violate the False Claims Act. Moving on to summary judgment, the district court got it right. They first examined the notice requirement, which is the second element of retaliation. There, the district court, citing the Reed case and the Chella case, determined that there was no notice by Mr. Sorensen to stop one or more violations of the False Claims Act. When you contrast his allegations in the complaint to his affidavit that came later, you'll see that I submit that there's a credibility issue there, because the complaint, for example, in paragraph 47 of the complaint, he says that he had a conversation with Frank Barney, who is the truck boss, regarding his pay discrepancy. You contrast that in his affidavit in paragraphs 35 and 36, he says he had the meeting with Frank Barney where they discussed David Bacon wages. Even at that, the affidavit doesn't get into any illegality, any evidence establishing that Wadsworth would have been put on notice of one or more efforts to stop the False Claims Act violations. And so the notice prong wasn't met. The district court then went on to say, but in the alternative, under the McDonnell-Douglas burden shifting, there's no pretext. And furthermore, there's no causation established in the affidavit and or complaint. And that specifically Wadsworth had a legitimate business reason for furloughing Mr. Sorensen. That was because the project was ending early. And based on that, and stating that it's not the court cannot second guess a company's legitimate business decision, that there was no pretext. In conclusion, I wanted to raise this issue that the state court decision, I think, has a persuasive impact on the court, in that under Rule 52A6 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, reviewing courts are encouraged or directed to give great weight to the credibility evaluation of a trial court judge's weight on the credibility of a witness. And the state court judge, the Third Judicial District, the presiding judge, heard all these Davis-Bacon arguments. It went to trial, and he determined in paragraph 37 in his findings that Mr. Sorensen was not credible. Quote, this court does not find Sorensen credible. Most of his testimony contradicts other credible witnesses, documentary evidence, and even his own statements.
Further, well, what is the pertinence of this, Mr. Beasley? Are you telling me that in a 12B6 analysis that we are supposed to determine because of what the state district court judge said, is that there is no Davis-Bacon violation at all? You can't believe this guy? Is that the stuff of 12B6?
No, the argument there, Your Honor, excuse me if I miscommunicated. The argument there goes to the credibility of Mr. Sorensen's affidavit on summary judgment grounds. That you, when you compare the affidavit to the complaint, there's inconsistencies. And then under Rule 52A6 and the full faith and credit clause, I encourage this court to give that weight to the credibility of Mr. Sorensen by looking at a district court judge in the state court that determined credibility issues, and
your position is, even if we have a genuine issue of material fact, difference in evidence, is it if a state court judge says, well, you shouldn't believe this person's evidence, then we should grant summary judgment?
No, I think it goes to the actual substance of the affidavit, not creating a genuine issue of material fact.
You mean that we dismiss, we don't consider the affidavit because it comes from a person who's been deemed by somebody else not to be credible?
Yes. And in addition to comparing it to the complaint and the inconsistencies there, we'll establish that, look, this looks like an affidavit simply to survive summary judgment. It's filled with hearsay. It's inconsistent and whatnot. Finally, Your Honor, I know my time is almost up, but the district court rendered a decision on February 3rd as to the attorney's fees. Mr. Sorensen missed his appeal deadline on that. And if the court reviews that February 3rd decision, you'll see that it goes to the merits of this case. It is not simply a collateral prevailing party. Wadsworth gets X amount of dollars. The court reviewed the entire scope of the action from start to finish, including the state court decision.
You're 30 seconds over time, but I do want to allow you to wrap up.
Okay, I will wrap this up. I would just encourage the court to review that February 3rd decision by Judge Waddups, because it goes to the merits and specifically says that Mr. Sorensen's claims for Davis-Bacon wages is unsupported.
Thank you.
And that can no longer be appealed.
Thank you. Judge Murphy, do you have any questions?
It's probably more appropriate to Mr. Monahan, but his time has expired. There's no issue before this panel on attorney's fees anymore, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Judge Briscoe?
How much of this state court ruling do we have in front of us in our record?
The entire ruling.
The entire ruling?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay.
Cited at the record at 95, Your Honor, the appendix 95, page 95.
Okay. And Paul, is that, I think that Judge Murphy is right on that Mr. Monahan's out of time. Is that right, Paul?
That's correct, Judge.
Okay. Well, thank you, counsel, for your submissions. This matter is submitted.